Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Are you listening to the Council of Trent podcast? Do you like this podcast? Do you hate me talking to you like this?
Yeah, you probably should be annoyed with me talking to you like this, because that's not the way you should talk to anybody, not even a baby. That's not the way you should talk to a baby to help them to grow up to be a healthy, well-developed, well-adjusted little human being. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn, and we're going to talk about babies, little kids today, how to understand them, how to speak to them, and the interesting and sometimes awful experiments that psychologists have performed on babies in order to learn more about them so we can better relate to them. So it's Free for All Friday here on the podcast, which means we get to talk about whatever I find to be interesting and helpful, whatever might be edifying to you or something that I just come across it just in my day-to-day life. And I think, you know, this would be something good to share with other people to learn about. And I think we need to do that because we live in a world, it's funny, we live in a world where babies are often expected to be like grown-ups, like they shouldn't be making a fuss, they shouldn't be imposing on other people. We get mad and irritated when they're on airplanes or in small spaces and they're making their noises that babies are in church, for example. And yet grown-ups are allowed to act like babies, are allowed to throw their little fits. It's like, my seat doesn't lean back. I didn't get the meal I wanted. My entertainment set is out. I need church to be exactly just right for me, or I'm not going to go because I'm not getting anything out of Mass. This is not the way I want it to be. Me. I'm getting a little worked up here, but that's hard for me when adults are basically allowed to act like babies and throw their little tantrums on social media about stuff. But babies aren't allowed to throw their own age-appropriate tantrums and express their discomfort for things. Now, what's funny is when I was younger in my college days, I was really bad with babies in the sense that I didn't know how to handle them. So I was uncomfortable. I would hold babies. People would say, Trent, just hold a baby. Just hold my baby. You'll be fine. I'm like, no, I really can't do this. And I would hold the baby and be uncomfortable. They would start to cry. I would get more uncomfortable, which would lead to them crying more. And it was a vicious feedback loop until the torture of me would, you know, ended and they would take the child back. And so I would eventually tell people I didn't like babies, but I wish I did. I liken this to C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, the famous Christian apologist and author, he used to say that he didn't like children, but he knew that he should like children. And I said that was the position that I had. And ultimately, it came down to inexperience with children. I thought that children, little babies, and I didn't have a baby. Like when I would see people with their little kids and the kids are climbing on the play equipment, I would be all anxious, like, oh, what if he falls? What if something happens? I thought babies were basically like made out of porcelain. Like if a baby fell down, I like imagine they would just like shatter into a million pieces. And so I was always just like nervous at the idea of holding a baby because it's like a wriggling porcelain vase that, you know, has great emotional sentiment to its owner. What if I drop it and it shatters into like a million pieces? But then I had children. And that's where everything changed. And now I have a 5-year-old and a soon-to-be 3-year-old. And I see that kids aren't like made of porcelain. They're really more made like with rubber. They actually bounce back. They're pretty resilient. I mean, you still have to be gentle, obviously. But they're not as extremely fragile as you would imagine them to be. So then when I had little Matthew, oh my goodness, he must have been like, you know, 6 months old when he could finally hold his head up. You know, hold his head up or sit up. I would hold him. And then, you know, do the thing where you're the dad, and every dad wants to do this, where you throw the kid up in the air. And I have this video. I threw him up in the air. It was several feet. He was going pretty high in our townhouse. And my goodness, he was just loving it. He was just going, ah! and so things changed for me. And now I just love seeing little kids. I love when they're at church and they make their age-appropriate noises. I don't mind sitting next to them on airplanes. Because like I said, we live in an age where adults are allowed to whine and complain and be little babies all the time. But children are not allowed to be babies often. You know, children are supposed to be seen, not heard. That's ridiculous. So what I want to talk about in today's podcast is how do we relate to babies, especially like babies, toddlers, understand them, and all the interesting psychological experiments that have been done to try to figure out how the brains of babies worked for us to have better ways to nurture them, to raise them, and to encourage proper and healthy development. But before we get to that, I must say, please help us at the Council of Trent podcast continue to do this work to help all the babies out there, not just help them to develop in a healthy way, but to develop at all, because we're doing pro-life work. We're helping people go and baptize their children in the Catholic faith. So if you want to help us reach more people here on the podcast, I would definitely encourage you to check out trenthornpodcast.com, where you get access to bonus content, sneak peeks of my upcoming books, debates, articles, dialogues, and also the ability to submit questions for our open mailbag episodes, which is always a fun thing to do. Check it out, all that and more at trenthornpodcast.com. All right, so the first thing I want to talk about is baby talk and babble. So obviously, most people do not talk to children like, "Hello, child, what are you doing today?" We know instinctively we're supposed to talk to children in a different way than we do other adults. And actually, if you speak to children in a very particular dialect called parentese, that's actually really good for their brain development. But a lot of people confuse parentese with baby talk. And baby talk is not actually as good for children's brains. So baby talk is the kind of thing where you use nonsensical words and sounds that don't make sense. Like, "Are woo-woozing or widow dozy-wozies? Are you wibbing your little dozy-wozies?" And it's hard to understand. And you think it's cute, but the baby's having a hard time understanding because the baby's trying to latch onto specific keywords and tones and a frequency and pitch in your voice to be able to understand what you're talking about. So instead of using baby talk or babble and nonsense words, researchers have found in the past few decades that parentese is something that is better to use. So you might say, "Are you wiggling your little toes? Are your toes moving back and forth?" So notice that it's different, that I'm clearly enunciating the words, but I'm speaking slower and with a voice that modulates a lot with pitch and frequency, because that modulation in tone, this almost melodic modulation, it's helpful for babies to lock onto particular signals in the way that we communicate. So this is a clip from researchers studying children. This is from BBC Earth Lab. They take these little kids and they put like the little brain helmet on them with the little little sensors to track the electrical activity in their brain. And then they speak to them in parentese and show the difference between normal speech, babble, and parentese, and how the children relate to it. So let's play that clip.
The team are using this setup to find out what's happening inside babies' brains when they listen to parentese.
"I can see you."
That special way of speaking that we all automatically seem to use whenever we talk to babies.
"I can see you."
Parentese is a way of speaking that heightens pitch, exaggerates the length of words, and is very rhythmic.
"Jump and jump."
Now Elsie's taking part in the experiment.
"Like you show me your toy?"
She listens carefully to the parentese.
"Where's the bear? Can you see him?"
But when it comes to the normal speech, she quickly loses interest. This pattern of behaviour is backed up by other studies that show babies prefer to listen to parentese.
"I can see you. I can see you."
But what's happening inside their brains?
"Bunny rabbits jump and jump."
But you can see the brainwaves changing in real time.
When Usher analyses the data, she discovers something extraordinary.
Baby's brain, the electrical signalling, is pulsing basically in time with those big rhythm patterns.
"I can see
this brain synchronization is represented in this simulation.
"Bunny rabbits jump and jump."
Usher and her team are the first in the world to show that parentese contains these large rhythmic modulations and that this matters for babies' developing brains.
So when you speak in parentese to a child, and notice that rhythmic, melodic setup, "I can see you," up and down, up and down, the baby's brain pulses in the same frequency. It's easier for them to track the language that we are using when we speak slower and then when it's very rhythmic and melodic, almost kind of sing-songy in that respect. So it's helpful to know, so you can definitely look up parentese and know that it is different than baby talk or babble. We shouldn't babble to children. We should speak slowly, and rhythmically and melodically with a very in between high pitch and lower pitch sounds. Here's something interesting also about baby talk, though. Have you ever noticed that every culture on earth has a word for mother and a word for water? And think about this. Every culture on earth, the cultures differ in lots of ways, but every culture on earth can't survive without water. So you have to have a word for water and you have to have a word for mother, because that's common to every culture on earth. Now, the words for water can be very different. Now, in Romance languages and European languages, they're often very similar because they all come from the same proto-Indic root. You know, there's a similar root there, especially in European languages. So we have water in English. I think it's Wasser in German, agua in Spanish, eau in French. But then when you get outside of the European range, if you get to the Philippines or, you know, East Asian islands in Tagalog, I think it's Tabig. In Japan, it's Misu. So very different. You go around the world, the word for water is very different. Words for other things like dog will be often very different in different cultures. But the word for mama and dada is actually almost the same. It's very similar cross-culturally. So according to an article in Atlantic, in Africa, Swahili has mama and baba. In the Philippines, Tagalog has nane and tate. Fijian has nana and tata. So it's either mama, baba, mama, dada, or nana, tata. So it's always that same kind of, either with the lips, mama, mama, ba, 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 or with the tip of the tongue on the roof of the mouth, na, 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 ta, 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 da, da, da. So it's one of those two basic sounds. In the Caucasus mountain ranges, it's nana and da. But then you go all the way to the Eskimos in North America, very cut off from these other languages, anana and atata. So, you know, it's the same as you go through. Why is that the case? This article says that pioneering linguist Roman Jacobson figured it out. If you're a baby making a random sound, the easiest vowel is ah, because you can make it without doing anything with your tongue or lips. I mean, think of it. If you're trying to make a noise, you're a baby, you're trying to figure out how to make words, you just open your mouth, you go, ah. You know, your mouth is open and you just have noise come out and you can make ah. That's the easiest sound you can make. But then you want to break it up to make some kind of distinctive sound. So it says that the first impulse is to break up that stream of ah by closing your lips for a spell, especially since you've been closing your lips for nursing. Hence, mmm, and you get that string of ma's as you keep the sound going while breaking it up at intervals. Babies speaking in this way are just playing, but adults don't hear them that way. A baby says mama, and it sounds as if he's addressing someone, and the person he's most likely addressing so early on is his mother. The mother takes mama as meaning her, and in speaking to her child, refers to herself as mama. So what's funny is we think that children, you know, very early on are saying mama, mama, as if, you know, they've learned the language from us. And in some cases they have, because they've heard us say, here's mama, mama's here. But the explanation for why this is a universal word was probably that you go back thousands of years, that children want to get attention from their caregiver. The caregiver that they will most likely have contact with is their mother. And ma, ma, ma is just the very first sound that children tend to be able to learn. Ma, ma, or na, 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 when they have their tongue more, not the lips, but their tongue on the roof of their mouth. Ma, ma, na, na. And so that's just the first sound they're able to make. And so cultures naturally adopted that when children make this sound, it's referring to, that's the sound they would always make in reference to their mother. But it just happened to be the first sound they learned, and they directed it at their earliest caregiver, which is usually their mother. A similar thing happens for dad. According to the article, papa and dada happen for a similar pan-human reason. After babies begin making mm with their lips, they pick up making a sound that involves a little more than just putting their lips together. Namely, putting them together, holding them that way for a second, and then blowing out a puff of air. That's pa, or depending on your mood, ba. So instead of ma, 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 you know, you have a little puff of air with it. So pa or ba. Probably overworking my microphone here with that. I'm sure Nick can fix that here in a bit. And also babies start playing with their mouths a little further back from their lips on that ridge behind the upper teeth that we burn inconveniently by sipping soup when it's too hot. That's where we make a T or a D sound. So if you're wondering why babies say mama, dada, and that's universal across almost all languages, either mama, dada, mama, papa, nana, tata, for mom and dad. That's because those are the very first sounds babies are able to learn to make. All right, let's talk about some other experiments on children. And this is an experiment. I'm glad it's not done on human infants because it's so sad, but it's done on little baby monkeys to understand their attachment to mothers and what people need, what living creatures, especially mammals and primates, need for proper growth and development and survival, what they value. So in a series of controversial experiments during the late 1950s and early 1960s, Harry Harlow studied the importance of a mother's love for healthy childhood development. In order to do this, he separated infant rhesus monkeys from their mothers a few hours after birth and left them to be raised by two surrogate mothers. One of the surrogates was made of wire with an attached bottle for food. The other was made of soft terry cloth but lacked food. What the researcher found was that the baby monkeys spent much more time with the cloth mother than the wire mother, thereby proving that affection plays a greater role than sustenance when it comes to childhood development. They also found that the monkeys that spent more time cuddling the soft mother grew up to be more healthy. This experiment showed that love, as demonstrated by physical body contact, is a more important aspect of the parent-child bond than the provision of basic needs. These findings also had implications in the attachment between fathers and their infants when the mother is the source of nourishment. So how the experiment works is you have the little baby rhesus monkey, and he goes in, and there's two cages he can choose to go to. One has it looks like a monkey made out of wire mesh that has a little bottle it can drink from, but it's a wire mesh monkey with eyes and a bottle you can drink from. The other one is a wire mesh monkey, but it's covered in soft terry cloth and has little eyes on it, and it looks more visually appealing, and it's softer to the touch. And you would think that the rhesus monkeys would go spend all their time with the food food monkey and just try to always get the milk out of the food monkey and just stay there. But they spent the vast majority of their time with the terry cloth monkey. They wanted that more than the food. And that's something that shows why physical bonding and nurturing is so important in a baby's early development. So here is a clip from the original Harlow study where they talk about this with the rhesus monkey. And that's the sound of the sound the monkey makes when he cuddles with his fake terry cloth mom.
Oh, he's going back.
He's back on the cloth mother, and he'll stay on the cloth mother. Actually, this baby spends 17 to 18 hours a day on the cloth mother and less than 1 hour a day on the wire mother. We had predicted that the variable of contact comfort would be a variable of measurable importance, but we were unprepared to find that it completely overwhelmed and overshadowed all other variables.
So go home and hug your kids tonight. And especially that, and this is something that psychologists took a long time for them to discover with children. I mean, it's amazing. Children have been around with the human race, obviously, for thousands of years. But we've only come up with really important insights into human development in like the last 70 years or so. I mean, you look at manuals from Victorian England and advice from the Middle Ages about how to raise children. And it's very crude and undeveloped. That especially in Victorian England, children were seen as just general nuisances that you had to just use strict authoritarian discipline over to kind of drive the devil out of them, basically. So it didn't lead to healthy development in children. But we had more advent from child psychology, and of course, I'm not saying child psychologists are infallible. Some of them will promote disastrous, awful, horrible things like gender reassignment therapy for children. So I'm not giving a carte blanche to modern child psychology by any means. But I do think that they have discovered many important things in experiments on children to counteract, even up into the modern age, mistaken views about infants and their abilities to interact with other people. One of these is called the still face experiment. So according to this article, why has this experiment, first published in the 1970s, become so important. Well, actually, let me talk about what the still face experiment is, and I'll play a short clip from it. And there's a video of it you can watch online. I'll probably include the links to this at trendhornpodcast.com. So if you want to watch the videos for yourself and see these kinds of interactions, if you're a patron at Trendhorn Podcast, there's another benefit, by the way, being a patron at trendhornpodcast.com. You get the ability to comment on the episodes exclusively. This is a community only for patrons. And you get access to the show notes, resources, the videos that I mention, which I'm not able to post anywhere else when the episodes go up. You can get access to the show notes for as little as $5 a month, along with all the other bonuses at trendhornpodcast.com. So the still face experiment, and you can watch it. It's so sad because the babies start to cry, and I'm such a softy now that I have kids. The mom will interact with the baby, and well, actually, I'll play the clip. This is Dr. Edward Tronick talking about the experiment itself, and the experiment involves what babies do when their mothers pay attention to them. And then what happens when they don't pay attention to them, and the ability of babies to be able to react to visual cues and understand social communication, social cues that are communicated through facial expressions. So here's a clip from their video about the still face experiment.
In the still face experiment, what the mother did was she sits down and she's playing with her baby who's about a year of age.
I'm like a girl.
Oh, and she gives a greeting to the baby. The baby gives a greeting back to her.
Yeah.
This baby starts pointing at different places in the world, and the mother's trying to engage her and play with her. They're working to coordinate their emotions and their intentions, what they want to do in the world. And that's really what the baby is used to. And then we ask the mother to not respond to the baby. The baby very quickly picks up on this.
So what the mother does, she turns her face away and then she looks back and it's just like stone cold, like just staring. No smile, no facial cues, just staring ahead with kind of a dead stare at the baby.
And then she uses all of her abilities to try and get the mother back. She smiles at the mother. She points because she's used to the mother looking where she points. The baby puts both hands up in front of her and says, "What's happening here?" She makes that screechy sound at the mother, like, "Come on, why aren't we doing this?" Even in this 2 minutes when they don't get the normal reaction, they react with negative emotions, they turn away, they feel the stress of it, they actually may lose control of their posture because of the stress that they're experiencing.
Okay. I'm here. And what are you doing? Oh, yes. Oh, what a big girl.
It's a little like the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is that normal stuff that goes on, that we all do with our kids. The bad is when something bad happens, but the infant can overcome it. After all, when you stop the still face, the mother and the baby start to play again. The ugly is when you don't give the child any chance to get back to the good. There's no reparation, and they're stuck in that really ugly situation.
It makes me so sad when I almost cry when I watch the still face. But I mean, it's important because like Dr. Tronick says, the baby can bounce back when this has only happened for just a few minutes. But it shows like how if children are raised in an emotionally abusive or neglectful environment, I mean, it affects them for the rest of their lives. I mean, that's why it is so important in the world we live in today. People talk about how do we solve the problems of the world? The family. The family is the number one thing because I'm sorry, children come from families. You need to have strong families where there is caring and nurturing and the families are healthy and well-adjusted to be able to provide this for children. Children don't just need someone to watch them and give them food and entertain them. They need that warm and tender care that comes from parents, both their mothers and their fathers is important. But that's the still face experiment. And it's important to see why this experiment is helpful. Trying to look through here. Well, it talks about the responses, but Tronick says that even in the early 70s, when still face was being started, people did not think that infants could respond to such social and visual cues. They were much more passive in that regard. And these and other experiments have shown that it's actually not the case. There were actually two other experiments that were done in the early part of the 20th century that are just terrible. That shows that people always say, science will figure everything out, as if science could give us all the answers to everything. Science does give us a lot of answers, but also there are questions and answers that you can't get from science, like what scientific experiments are okay and which ones are not okay. Science cannot give us an answer to that question because there are very famous experiments in science that were clearly not okay. I'll give you two examples dealing with child development. One is the Little Albert experiment. This involved John Watson, Rosalie Rayner at Johns Hopkins University back in 1920. They were trying to figure out how phobias could manifest from an early age. So if someone's afraid of mice, why might they be afraid of mice? And so they took like a little guy, just one boy, Little Albert, and they had him play with a little mouse. And every time he touched the mouse, they would strike a suspended steel bar with a hammer. It was very loud, and he would cry and get afraid. And eventually, they would do this not just with a rat, but with any kind of soft, fluffy object. And then eventually, Albert did not want to. He became distressed. What happened was they always struck it when he played with the little white rat. And then little Albert would become frightened anytime he saw anything that resembled a white rat, like a rabbit, a dog, even the little puffy beard on a Santa Claus mask. So, of course, this is a horrible experiment that's traumatizing a child. It's not like the still face experiment where it's, you know, very short in duration. It's something that went on over long periods of time where the child was not able to recuperate properly. And of course, it's a totally invalid experiment because it only has one test subject you can't generalize from. But it became famous and actually, yeah, so it became famous through child development circles to try to understand deep-seated fears or beliefs that could be rooted in childhood. Another one that was a larger study done in Davenport, Iowa in 1939 is called the Monster Study that was done on 22 orphan children. And you're like, well, this is already not off to a promising start. And so what happened was Mary Tudor was a graduate student working under Wendell Johnson at the University of Iowa. And what they did was they took students with for speech therapy, 22 orphan children. It's already off to a bad start because they have no parents advocate for them. And what they would do is many of the normal speaking orphan children, they would give them positive and negative speech therapy, praising fluency of speech. The other half, they had negative speech therapy, where you had children who had normal speaking abilities who were given negative therapy, where they were mocked for their speech patterns, they were belittled, and of course, as you might expect, they developed speech impediments as a result. This study was dubbed the Monster Study, as some of Johnson's peers were horrified that he would experiment on orphan children to confirm a hypothesis. The experiment was kept hidden for fear of Johnson's reputation to be tarnished in the wake of human experiments conducted by the Nazis in World War II. They were never published in any peer-reviewed journal. Tudor's graduate thesis is the only official record of the experiment. The University of Iowa publicly apologized for the Monster Study in 2001, though Patricia Zabrowski, a University of Iowa professor of speech pathology, says that the data, it was one of the largest collections of data on the phenomenon of stuttering at that time period, and so it still had some utility, is what Zabrowski argued. So yeah, those are two that are terrible, obviously. I'm like, oh, goodness, poor little kiddos. Let's talk about two more studies. These ones are actually much better and have been very helpful in learning to understand child development. One is called the Bobo Doll Experiment. So a Bobo Doll Experiment was created by Albert Bandura in the 1960s, and it was meant to study human aggression. So what Bandura would do is he would take a Bobo doll. It's a doll-like toy with a rounded bottom and a low center of mass that rocks to an upright position. You ever have those old toys? I mean, they have clown ones like this. I remember it being a an umpire. It was an inflatable umpire that you could punch, and it would lean back, and then it would come right back up again. You remember those toys? So they had one of those with Bobo the doll. And the kids would watch an adult hit Bobo the doll, yell at Bobo the doll, scream at the doll, hit him, be really aggressive. And they would just watch this. And the kids went into a room with toys and Bobo the doll and were allowed to do whatever they want. And what the kids would do, kids who saw an adult being aggressive to Bobo the doll would then be aggressive themselves and mimic that behavior. Whereas kids who saw someone be nice and polite and gentle with Bobo the doll would imitate the nice and gentle behaviors. So the experiments tested social learning theory. Social learning theory claims that people learn largely by observing, imitating, and modeling. It demonstrates that people learn not only by being rewarded and punished, operant conditioning. So you don't learn things just by being rewarded and punished for your behavior, but if you watch someone else being rewarded or punished, or see someone, if you see someone else does something and they're not punished for it, that teaches you that the behavior is okay, or at least you're allowed to do it too, because they did not get punished. So here's some commentary. I think this is by Bandura himself on the original Bobo doll experiment.
It was once widely believed that seeing others vent aggression would drain the viewer's aggressive drive. As you can see, exposure to aggressive modeling is hardly cathartic.
So what he's talking about here is the idea that you could think, oh, well, seeing someone be angry makes you less angry, or hitting a doll makes you less angry because it's cathartic. Actually, when you get angry, it makes you more angry. So it's not as cathartic. And then you see they're disturbing images. You see like these little kids, hitting their hitting the doll, and they're always just like really upset about things. And it seems like every kid from like the 1960s and the 1970s, every like 10-year-old boy always look to me. They always look the same in these old vintage videos. Every 10-year-old boy looks like the same kid with like the same crew cut hairstyle and beady eyes. And they're just upset and mad. And their dad was mean to them because their dad grew up in the 1930s in the Depression, and they never got the emotional development and care when they were younger that they needed back in the 50s. And now they're going to take it out on poor Bobo the doll. So to look that up, Bobo doll experiment. The last one is the visual cliff experiment. So this is one by Eleanor Gibson and Richard Walk, done back in the 1960s. And what you would do is you would take a little baby, and the baby would walk on a checkerboard pattern, and they would see what looks like a cliff, a drop-off of several feet, where the checkerboard pattern goes down like 3 feet, and that's a big fall for a little baby who's just learning to crawl. However, there is a plexiglass cover on top of the checkerboard that goes all the way across. So it looks like a drop, but it actually isn't. So the babies will crawl all the way up to the edge of the cliff, and then they will stop, and they don't want to go further anymore. Now, usually they'll place like a toy at the edge of the cliff on the other side of the drop-off, and the kids want to go to the toy, but they don't want to fall off the cliff. So the mother will be on the other side and will make expressions to them, either a happy expression or a scared expression. And this baby, who's just learning to crawl, by the way, can read that cue from their mother, whether it's happy or scared, and act accordingly. When the mother is scared, they don't go across the visual cliff. But when the mother is happy, they feel that it's trusting, and then they're willing to go and give it a shot. So I'll play a little bit from that, from Joseph Campos talking about the visual cliff experiment and what is gathered from it.
This particular study demonstrates the role of nonverbal communication in determining the child's behavior in uncertain contexts. A baby will, when they encounter something ambiguous, something uncertain, will typically look to the significant other, the mother, the father, a grandparent, the caregiver, in order to figure out what to do. So by 11 to 12 months of age, the baby is already doing what all of us do when something unusual happens. We look around to figure out how other people are reacting.
So babies are just like us. They're they're just little people, whether they're born or unborn. If they're unborn, they haven't developed these personal characteristics yet, but everything that child is present from the moment of conception. It just needs to develop, and it continues to develop long after birth. People always think it's not a person yet because it's not developed. Look at this. Kids are developing their whole lives. You and I are developing our whole lives. So let's continue to help all of us to develop in healthy and good ways. Well, thank you so much for stopping by the Council of Trent podcast. I really appreciate it. I'll have to do a follow-up. There's so many other studies, not just on children, but even adults, that are just fascinating to look at. An honorable mention that didn't make the full cut. There's one where they have babies pushing. Look it up online. I'll include it in the link at trentornpodcast.com. The shopping cart study, where a baby is supposed to push a little shopping cart, and it has a carpet under it. And so it's tied to the shopping cart. So when the baby is standing on the carpet, they can't move the shopping cart. And they're like, what the heck is this monstrosity? And little kids, like 12, 14 months old, don't get it. They don't see that them standing on the carpet keeps the cart from moving because they don't have a full sense of self. But then 18-month-old, 20-month-old children, they can figure it out because they see that they are the ones who are stopping the cart from moving. They have an impact on their environment. Check it out, the baby human shopping cart study. Interesting one there, honorable mention. But thank you all. Glad you all were able to stop by. And I hope that you have a very blessed day and a very blessed weekend. If you have children, give your kids a hug for me. And even if you don't, be nice to a child, smile and wave, and let them know we are glad that they are here. Thank you all so much. Have a very blessed weekend.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.